Hello, everyone, and welcome back to another episode of The Damage Report with me, John Iderola. It's a big Tuesday. The news is coming out fast, and it's just the worst. And you know who I want with me to wade through the swamp that is today's news? Progressive activist Jordan Yule. Welcome back.
John, thank you for having me.
Sorry, I said progressive activist. What I should have said is the most viral man on the internet, Jordan Yule. How's it going, man?
It's going well. That's not a title I would self-apply, but thanks.
Well, we'll workshop it, but I mean, look, obviously I'm sure that you already know, but the work that you've done in assembling montages of the brutality that's been visited upon protesters around the country have been spread far and wide, you know, obviously has helped to open some people's eyes that might not have seen this footage, and it might have been, especially considering if you just watch Fox News, you'll never have seen any of this. Having it be spread in such an easily digestible format is obviously very helpful, and so thank you for doing that.
Sure. Yeah, happy to.
And let's see, everyone joining us in the chat, thank you very much. I saw a comment, something about how every koala has chlamydia. I did not know that. Thank you for the science news of the day chat. But while you're talking about the STDs of marsupials, I think, could you also hit the like button, maybe share the stream? That'd be nice. You want to get more people in so we can spread the word about both police brutality and also the animal kingdom. Actually, on that note, yesterday on the show, I had an animal activist on. We talked about pangolins and the continued trafficking against them. And so that interview should be up on the channel in just a few days. Definitely take a look at that. There's a lot going on. We're trying to keep track of everything. And with that, Jordan, what do you think? You ready to jump into this thing?
Let's do it.
Okay, let's do it. Within the last week, one of the standout videos of police brutality has to be the assault against 75-year-old peace activist Martin Gugino. And I'm going to show you the video again, because we are being forced to discuss this because of an awful tweet from Donald Trump. But as always, when I show you this, I want you to know that this is incredibly graphic, and so consider yourself warned. Cringe every time. It is an absolutely brutal video, and he immediately began bleeding out of his ear. He was admitted to the hospital. He is, as of this morning, apparently still in critical condition. But despite that, despite the obvious, needless, excessive force there, and a man who could still die, might never fully recover, this is what the President of the United States had to say about this morning. Buffalo protester shoved by police could be an Antifa provocateur. 75-year-old Martin Gugino was pushed away after appearing to scan police communications in order to black out the equipment. I watched. He fell harder than he was pushed. Was aiming scanner could be a setup? Now that's difficult to understand what he's getting at, because most of us don't watch OANN news, so we're not subjected to the mindless, senseless conspiracy theorizing there. But he took it at face value. And so now millions and millions of Americans believe that that 75-year-old deserved what he got, Jordan.
Yeah, this was an unbelievably callous comment from Donald Trump. And a mutual friend of ours, Jared Holt, pointed out earlier today that this theory originates from a right-wing, like just kind of fringe conspiracy site called Conservative Treehouse, based on an anonymous comment left on that site. Jesus. So it went from anonymous comment to this site to OANN to the president. Like, that is a dangerous pipeline. And for someone with that kind of reach and that kind of power and influence to, you know, further this claim could likely lead to harassment, possibly incitement to violence against this guy. Because as we've seen, Trump has done this before, whether it's like inspiring the guy who wanted to bomb CNN or bomb different prominent liberals Trump's Twitter and his pushing of conspiracy theories can often lead to dangerous consequences. And now this guy is in a hospital. He's bedridden. He's in critical condition. And you have the president of the United States pushing conspiracy theories, claiming this guy, who for all we know is just some senior citizen who wanted to. I mean, that is what it is. Not just for what we know, he is. And he was a peace activist who was trying to return, from what we understand, a helmet to the police that they had dropped, and they shoved him. And now he's in critical condition. And the president just piling on is so unbelievably callous. I don't know what to say other than that.
Yeah, reasonable people are just left effectively speechless at the brutal, willful dishonesty, and not just lack of empathy for a person who's been horribly injured, but to use the position you've been given, tragically, from America's point of view, to convince millions of other Americans to put aside the empathy they might be feeling, to tell them, don't believe your lying eyes. Your eyes are telling you, and your ears hearing his skull crack on the pavement, are telling you that something terrible has happened. But no, he was just scanning the police equipment. I don't even know what that means. And even if that's what he was doing, and I feel fairly certain that's not what he was doing, even if that was what he was doing, you don't get to crack his skull open. But also, let's look at, he didn't just say he was scanning the equipment, so maybe it was a setup. Yeah, he wanted to be in the hospital for a week in critical condition. He's Antifa. Because as we said at the beginning, Antifa now means whatever they want it to mean. You have Obamagate for politics, and you have Antifa for the protesters. So if you're watching this, and you go out there and you get injured, you might find out that you are Antifa too after the fact, if that's what it takes to justify this police brutality.
Yeah, and this is the danger of these like wide-ranging labels that just get conveniently applied. Terrorist was the term that was just this kind of situation in the 2000s. Everything was terror, and everything was terrorism. We had no actual definition for a very long time, so it was conveniently applied whenever it politically suited whoever was applying it. Mm-hmm. So now we have the same thing with Antifa. It's not an actual organization or structure or anything. It's just people who are against fascism. And now you're using that and they want to do the same thing. They want to conflate this with terrorism and domestic terrorism, which would then lead to the erasure of civil liberties for people who are protesting, even peacefully, and people who just generally oppose fascism. So here we have this term being wildly misapplied to an old man who is, again, in the hospital. Yeah. So this is the danger in rushing to apply these types of labels. And I would urge people on the left not to try to be so flippant, or not be so flippant in the application of domestic terrorism for enemies on the right, because that just opens the door and sets a precedent for it to be applied back on the left. Mm-hmm.
A couple more notes. So he apparently had been working recently on trying to expand access to affordable housing in Buffalo. Antifa provocateur. Dangerous. That's what he was working on, this 75-year-old man. And by the way, so the police officers who were suspended over doing this, the ones you saw in the video, and then basically the entire unit left, because if they're not going to be allowed to crack old men's skulls, then what's the point of even being on the job? Well, a Florida police union apparently posted a message on its Facebook page addressing those who'd assaulted Martin, saying they were hiring. Because even though the only thing they know about these two cops is that they needlessly, horribly, grievously injured someone, that's all they need to know, and they want them aboard. That's what these unions are. And that's how it works, by the way. Even if they get fired, they'll be hired somewhere else to continue the wave of violence. And with Trump on the tweet, I noted Jules Sosdaltsev, who I know we both know, he just tweeted, "I wish I believed in hell." And I'm right there with him. I don't, but sometimes, like, Trump is going to be fine. He's not going to be banned from Twitter or anything for doing this. The consequences, which are hopefully coming electorally, will never be enough to undo the damage that he has done and continues to do on a day-to-day basis. It is sickening. It is an assault on everything that should be good about America. And I'm just sick of it. That's all I can say.
Yeah, I mean, one final point on the police unions thing. I mean, this is an issue that predates Trump, unfortunately. And this has been pointed out by activists and people who have worked, including in the Civil Rights Division at the DOJ, to investigate police departments. One of the biggest things preventing progress on this issue and stopping police brutality is the police unions and how they structure their contracts. There's like there's provisions in so many police contracts, police union contracts, that allow them all to convene and get together for multiple days after an incident to get their story straight. So then you're coming up against a unified, unionized force in a court of law or in a complaint process or anything, and they can easily pick holes in like eyewitnesses and bystanders and the victim and all that kind of stuff to beat the case. And because they work so closely with prosecutors and district attorneys, and it's kind of a symbiotic relationship, it's like very hard for, you know, attorneys and lawyers and district attorneys to actually convict a cop, because they, in the end, they need them.
Yeah.
They need the cops' cooperation in the long run more than they're going to need yours. Yeah. So they so often turn a blind eye to it or defer to a grand jury, which is way more sympathetic. So the unions and how they structure the unions, and like you just said, the behavior where they're looking out for their own and that kind of stuff, it's so dangerous. And that's like the one union that I just absolutely don't support.
Yeah. Yeah. And by the way, really fast. So there's been like a lot of discussion online about reform police versus defund the police. Should you really be pushing to defund the police? That's not pragmatic. But the thing is, reforming the police, because of what Jordan is describing there, is virtually impossible, because even the most minor reforms face an adamantium wall of opposition from the union. It becomes very hard to do that. Not impossible, but very hard. Defunding the police is, you know, aside from the financial corruption of these unions supporting politicians who will then support them, theoretically possible, because you can actually cut funding to the police, whether the unions like it or not. And so it might not only be the moral choice, but it might in fact be the politically pragmatic choice, because it is at least in the hands of state legislators. Yeah. We need to talk about a relatively new show called The Republic, or UNFTR. As a Young Turks fan, you already know that the government, the media, and corporations are constantly peddling lies that serve the interests of the rich and powerful. But now there's a podcast dedicated to unraveling those lies, debunking the conventional wisdom. In each episode of The Republic, or UNFTR, the host delves into a different historical episode or topic that's generally misunderstood or purposely obfuscated by the so-called powers that be, featuring in-depth research, razor-sharp commentary, and just the right amount of vulgarity. The UNFTR podcast takes a sledgehammer to what you thought you knew about some of the nation's most sacred historical cows. But don't just take my word for it. The New York Times described UNFTR as consistently compelling and educational, aiming to challenge conventional wisdom and upend the historical narratives that were taught in school. For as the great philosopher Yoda once put it, "You must unlearn what you have learned." And that's true whether you're in Jedi training or you're uprooting and exposing all the propaganda and disinformation you've been fed over the course of your lifetime. So search for UNFDR in your podcast app today and get ready to get informed, angered, and entertained all at the same time. One of the most closely watched upcoming primaries remaining is in New York, where incumbent Elliot Engel is facing a hard challenge from Jamal Bowman, who's been interviewed multiple times on this channel. Those are available online. You can take a look at them. Recently, Representative Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez actually endorsed the primary challenger, and Engel has not responded well to that. Here's how he pitched her move.
This is not a dictatorship. This is the democracy. We shouldn't have one person from high, even though she's a colleague of mine, think that she can anoint whoever is elected to Congress. That's not what democracy is all about. So I'm tried and true. I've been there. I've worked hard. I've done things for people. As I said to people, 2-year term, I asked for a renewal of my contract for another 2 years.
Okay, so we're going to have a lot more on this, but he found this tweet and endorsement. The fact that she says, you know, I think he's great, he's what's needed, that is, we have now dipped our toe in the pool of dictatorship, because she believes she can anoint him by endorsing him. That's a weird move.
I mean, wow, wait until he hears about how the DCCC works. I mean, there's like audio footage of Steny Hoyer explicitly telling people that, you know, sorry, hey, DCCC, DSCC, DNC, they've picked in these races. There's nothing we can do about it. Sorry, totally, to the primary challenger you support. I mean, that's just how that machine works. And he's like, yeah, like crying foul because it's finally going against him. And that's not even the machine. It's just outsiders. It's insurgents and progressive challengers. Mm. He just knows she is super well-liked and super popular and has a lot of sway. And he now sees that he's probably going to lose a spot. But this is, you know, also, I think you've probably talked about it, I'm sure, but the clip of him saying, like, if I didn't have a primary challenge, I wouldn't care.
100%.
And it's just like, he's just going through the motions now that he's finally forced to campaign again. He's flailing, and it's showing, like, he's just not really with it. He's just looking to coast by, and I think people, voters, should recognize that. When you have someone talking so flippantly about their race and why they wouldn't care if they didn't have a primary challenge, do you think that person represents your interests? Do you think they actually care about you and your concerns? Mm-hmm. Do you think they're going to go into Congress and represent you? Or do you think that maybe, just maybe, they're going to go in and push their agenda or their lobbyists or, like, the lobbyists they're cozy with or their campaign donors and people like that? I think people should really, if you're in that district, seriously consider not voting for Engel, because this guy is clearly not with it. He doesn't care about the interests of the voters or constituents, and comments like that are so telling.
Yeah, 100%. Like, he was found out. The video came out. We know who he is, and we know that type of politician. We know the person who's comfortable, and they're in their seat, and they don't think, hey, I never really have to defend myself. General election is always going to be super simple. Primaries are generally super simple. I can just sit here for the rest of my life, taking money. I get to go to, like, cool lunches and dinners, and I feel important, and I don't have to do anything. That's who we're trying to weed out of elected office. And the contrast could not be any stronger here. AOC, before she was actually sworn in, was protesting in the halls of Congress. Within months of being brought in, she was already changing the national dialogue about the most important issues facing America because she actually cares. She wasn't just doing it because there was a primary and she had to pretend to care for a little while. She actually cares. Elliot Engel, he now cares just about defeating Jamal Bowman. That's pretty much it. And by the way, you know, I know he's concerned about anointing and dictatorship and all of that. And so I have unfortunate news that in April of this year, Elliot Engel was a dictator when he endorsed Joe Biden for president. Who is he to think that he can just anoint someone in the presidential process? No, that's how endorsements work. I endorse people all the time. I'm not a dictator. I'm barely anything. Anyway.
Wow.
So if he was angry about AOC, wait until he hears about the news of this morning, because Bernie Sanders has endorsed Jamal Bowman. Now, Bernie Sanders does not necessarily endorse a lot of primary challengers to incumbent Democrats. Notably, he didn't endorse AOC, despite the fact that she had worked on his campaign and they had that affiliation or whatever. But he is doing it here. It's entirely possible that Alexandria paved the way for Bernie to do this. Maybe he would have done it anyway. He made other endorsements. We'll talk about that in a moment. But AOC, this is leadership here. Can you imagine what Engel, Jordan, can you imagine what Engel is going to say when he gets wind of this Bernie endorsement?
Oh, I can't imagine. You got to imagine, though, he's panicking. Like, because now you have two of the most popular politicians in the country backing your primary opponent, bringing national attention to this race. And with that will come increased donations, which will allow Bowman to do more ads and get, you know, hire more staff to get out the vote, things like that. This is huge. But it also shows, like, this movement isn't just built around Bernie. Because, like you said, AOC probably paved the way for Bernie to even do this. Bernie was the torch carrier for a little bit, inspired a new wave of progressive members of Congress and elected officials around the country. And now this is continuing to grow. And it's kind of like a symbolic passing of the torch with AOC now leading the way on endorsements. She's got her PAC that she's doing to help prop up candidates as well. I mean, this is blossoming into, I hope, a sustained progressive movement, because, like, this isn't just about Bernie. It's about all of us working together to call for progressive positive change.
Yeah.
So people like Bowman could, you know, then pave the way for another wave. And I think I'm extremely optimistic. I'm hopeful that Bowman wins. We'll see. I feel like people are starting to wake up.
Yeah. I hope so. And they're looking for leaders, and they're also looking for soldiers. Like, they're looking for the next wave. I saw an article. It was, I think it was in the New York Times. It might have been Post. I don't know. It was, is Jamal Bowman the next AOC? And he retweeted it saying, you know, no disrespect to my sister AOC, but I want to be the next Jamal Bowman, which is very similar to another candidate, Nabila Islam, whose election is today. Another good progressive. Go vote for her if you're in a district. Yeah, we need Bowmans and we need Omars and we need all of that. And so, especially considering what happened earlier this year, that's what we need. Now, really fast, I want to give you Bowman's response to that endorsement. He said, I'm honored to have the endorsement of Bernie Sanders, someone who's been fighting for civil rights, racial and economic justice, and on behalf of working people for his entire life. He led the way for the kind of campaign we're running, grassroots and no corporate donations. Who knows? I mean, Elliot Ingalls is an incumbent. You can't do traditional sort of progressive style on the ground campaigning right now. It is going to be a hard election, but he's getting a lot of new donations. He's getting a lot of attention. We could really use another big win like that. And I also wanted to mention there were other endorsements. So Bernie also endorsed Cori Bush, who's been, she's been on the network several times. That's out in Missouri's 1st District. And in addition to Cori Bush, we also have Mike Siegel in Texas's 10th District, Mondaire Jones in the 17th District of New York, and we have Charles Booker in Kentucky, the Senate race as well. AOC also endorsed him. And so that is great because Charles Booker is going up against, just about one of the Trump-friendliest Democrats running for office this year. And by the way, Semelis Lopez, who is also, she was on the program just about a week or two ago, Bernie also endorsed her running in a New York primary too. So a lot of different candidates. If you live in some of these districts, you might want to take a look at. They've now gotten the Sanders stamp of approval. Senator Ed Markey is facing a primary challenge from Joe Kennedy. It is a race that has frustrated many. Now it seems like most of the frustration is going to be on the part of Kennedy, who faced a withering assault from Ed Markey at their debate yesterday. Take a look at this.
Congressman Kennedy had a chance to sign on to Medicare for All when it was introduced. I stood with Bernie Sanders to fight for health care for everyone. Medicare for All. It took Congressman Kennedy 2 years to sign on to Medicare for All. That's not progressive leadership. Congressman Kennedy decided he was going to work for a right-wing Republican district attorney. That's not progressive leadership. Congressman Kennedy decided that he was going to vote to send military weapons to the local police in our country. That's not progressive leadership. Congressman Kennedy had a chance when he gave the State of the Union response to Donald Trump to talk about climate change. Congressman Kennedy did not mention the word climate change in his response. Congressman Kennedy is a progressive in name only. When he gets a chance to lead on Medicare for All, on climate change, on the militarization of the streets of this country, he was not a progressive leader. And when he had to make a decision as to who he was going to work for as a lawyer, he decided to work as a lawyer for a right-wing Republican. That is not the kind of progressive leadership which our country needs desperately right now.
That's just about the most fired up I've seen Ed Markey. And obviously he's facing a strong challenge. I mean, like a lot of centrists think, you know, Ed Markey's been kind of outspoken recently, supporting legislation we don't like. Maybe we push him to the side, get Kennedy in, much more comfortable with his brand of progressivism. But that was great to watch.
Yeah. Markey has championed things like the Green New Deal, Medicare for All. He's been, you know, perfectly fine progressive senator. But to elect Kennedy would be a shift right. I mean, there's no real reason to do that. This is purely because Kennedy has higher political aspirations. I mean, you could assume he's going to try to run for president eventually. He was, you know, the kind of the golden boy for a few years in the Democratic Party. He did the State of the Union response in, I think, 2017 or 18. This is, you know, someone that they're grooming for, you know, bigger and better things. So then the Senate would be the next step up for him. But there's no real justification for it because there's no problem with Markey.
Yeah.
He didn't even get into it, but like Kennedy also voted to give Trump nukes and then said it was an accident when people like caught on and called him out on it.
Yes.
Like, how do you do that? You have one job. Like you vote on legislation and you accidentally vote to give a maniac nuclear weapons.
The buttons are really close together, Jordan. It's like you accidentally slip.
Oh.
And then oops. We gave him Madman more nukes. Yeah, there's no... Why is he running? Why is he running against Ed Markey? Ed Markey hasn't had, like, some horrendous scandal or horrible votes that his constituents hate. It's just a... He's in my way. This is my year. I want the seat. Why? Nobody... No... What organic bottom-up push was there for him to assume a higher office? Who thought that? He gave the State of the Union response. It sucked. It was an opportunity before a national audience to prove what a real progressive you were. It was lame. It was the sort of... It was... From my point of view, to be fair, the people pushing him, the backers, the donors, all of that, it's exactly what they want, because he seems like the sort of person that he's young, he can occasionally use a sort of language that seems progressive, and we really want to get some of those kids that like that sort of thing, you know? But he doesn't actually challenge power in any discernible fashion. So he's the perfect, like, golem for them, I guess. For us, no. He's just trying to take out Ed Markey, who, by the way, like, we have to defend him now. It's not like Ed Markey's, like, some crazy out-and-out leftist or anything like that. He's good on the most important issues, and we want more people like that. But, like, Kennedy replacing that would just be devastating. I mean, it's going to be bad enough that to take back the Senate at all this time around, it is going to involve bringing in some more senators that are going to be obstacles to getting the sort of legislation we want passed. But he would be an actual step backwards along the way. There is no reason whatsoever to support Kennedy in this race.
Yeah. I mean, you talk about him, you know, trotting out the vernacular and the language to kind of appeal to younger people. But let's look at that in practice, right? So in the wake of the George Floyd murder at the hands of the Minneapolis police and the Minneapolis uprising, everyone is coming out and putting out statements about racial justice and police brutality and Black Lives Matter. And how does Kennedy frame his? Just by saying, lives matter. We believe lives matter. Yeah. Didn't even say all and did not specify Black. And then he's like, just gives this hollow statement about how lives matter and we need to stand up for lives. It just – he's avoiding the crux of the issue because he's probably afraid that, you know, in racist Boston, people would have backlash. Well, that's not the kind of bold progressive leadership. You don't cave because you think there's racists out there. People might not like it. What Markey was saying was – Kennedy is not a bold progressive leader because he won't lead on these issues. That's a perfect example. He was waiting and drafting, like kind of hiding behind other people with this tepid statement just because he didn't want to stick his neck out. Because this isn't about progressivism to him. It's about career aspirations. This guy is a total opportunist and you should be aware.
Yeah. 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 Very, very bold. You're in favor of lives. Yeah. And think about it. Like this time right now, if you have cared about these issues for a long time, this is an opportunity for finally some progress. But if you are comfortable with the status quo, this is a situation to be managed. It is a time to just keep your head down, say just enough, and just get by it. Hope it ends soon. Hope it doesn't rock the boat. And then eventually get back to ground you feel a little bit more steady on. And it is very clear, like you can, but I don't have him here for you, but if you're watching this, take a look at what he has said about these protests. Take a look at what Ed Markey has said about these protests, and that will lay it all out for you. As the protests have swept across the country over the past few weeks, Fox News has had a number of takes that I take issue with. Tucker Carlson has been really just falling apart. I want to show you two videos, and I want you to see what he is teaching his audience about what they're witnessing in this moment.
What is this about? Even the outlines are blurry at this point, but we know this. No matter what they tell you, it has very little to do with Black lives, if only it did. If Democratic leaders cared about saving the lives of Black people, and they should, they wouldn't ignore the murder of thousands of young Black men in their cities every year. They wouldn't put abortion clinics in Black neighborhoods. They would instead do their very best to improve the public schools and to encourage intact families, which we know beyond a shadow of a doubt is central to the life prospects of children. This may be a lot of things, this moment we're living through, but it is definitely not about Black lives. And remember that when they come for you, and at this rate, they will.
So that's Tucker Carlson. I would say indisputably the most high-profile racist in America right now, certainly has the largest audience. Like, Sean Hannity has all of his issues, and I have no doubt he's a racist, but he prioritizes it a lot less. He's more of just a out-and-out Trump bootlicker. Tucker Carlson says, what is this about? And you'll notice he doesn't say, to find out, we bring on BLM activists, whoever. No, he tells you what it's about. You don't have to listen to any of what these protesters are saying. I'm going to tell you what it's about. And it's not about black lives. In fact, it's about violence against you. They're coming for you. That's what he tells his audience.
Yeah. I mean, fortunately, I've had to watch and listen to a lot of Tucker Carlson over the years. And this guy is, like you said, one of the most out-and-out racists that is in mainstream media right now. And on top of Fox, he's got the Daily Caller, which acts as an extension of his reach. And this is just par for the course for him. And this isn't even, like, the most offensive thing I've heard from him.
No.
When I was going through the Bubba the Love Sponge tapes, like the Shock Jock show that he would just call into for years, just blatant, horrific racism, tons of like racist tropes and mocking civil rights leaders and doing like really offensive impressions, calling and this is they're not black, but people of color, semi-literate primitive monkeys. Just blatant, just offensive racism. And he just doesn't care because it doesn't matter to him. This is like Tucker is a white nationalist. Madeline Peltz at Media Matters has tracked this descent that he's had from just standard pundit to white nationalist. He's platformed white nationalists on his show. This is what he believes. I mean, Tucker Carlson is a racist. This isn't like a bold claim. It's just it is what it is. You look at the transcripts. Yeah. You look at what he said and you look at what he's done.
Yeah. Yeah. No, he brings on people to push the Camp of the Saints, one of the most racist books in history. The semi-literate primitive monkeys. I am still shocked that it didn't affect him at all. Like, how many people have lost jobs for nothing in comparison to that? Comments that are horrendous and offensive, but that he is just telling you who he is. And he does it. You know, he does it every night. I mean, this is a guy who says he tried to pretend there at the beginning. It's not about black lives. I wish it was. That's why I do segments all the time on white genocide in South Africa, because I care about what's going on. That's why I support economic policies that devastate the very communities I say I want to be stable and well off. It's the most shallow, fake populism, fake critical thought. He asks one of the true marks of an idiot or a liar, because I think that he's smart enough that he's probably just lying, is to ask rhetorical questions as if you couldn't find out the answer if you wanted to. If you wanted to know what the protests were about, there are ways to do so. You could go on Twitter for 5 minutes, or you could certainly interview people, but he doesn't do that. And he trains people to ask questions like that and not seek answers. He gets credit all the time. People hand it to him over his willingness to question the dogma of the Republican Party and things like that. He doesn't do that. He trains people to be stupid, to be incurious, to think weakly and loosely and vaguely about what's going on, and to assume at all times that their position is one of moral and intellectual superiority. I mean, he's telling you, do not listen to these people. They're lying to you, and they're going to come for you. And I want to transition now to the second video, because there's actually a little bit more of that.
Chaos, you're not allowed to defend yourself. You are, in other words, and this is, of course, the point, wholly dependent upon them. In the future, the left envisions the only people who will have guns are people on their team. And that's exactly what defund the police really means. It means a woke militia policing our cities, enforcing Democratic Party orthodoxy. Imagine if the diversity and inclusion department at Brown University had the power to arrest you. Imagine if the Black Lives Matter rioters had weapons and immunity from prosecution. That's what they're talking about. Partisan law enforcement. And partisan law enforcement, incidentally, is hardly without precedent. In fact, it's the rule in the third world. This is an attempt to bring it here.
I mean, Jordan, I don't know if you spoke. I couldn't hear. My ears are ringing from the dog whistle there. So the diversity and inclusion, I'm not going to say who would be running it, but the diversity and inclusion department at Brown is going to snatch you out of your home. Woke militias are going to walk the streets. And wink, wink, it's like the third world, but it's coming here. The third world's going to be here in the streets. BLM protesters are going to have guns, are going to be walking the streets. We're supposed to pretend that this guy, this is David Duke level stuff. And he's got an audience of millions absorbing this every day.
Yeah, I mean, it's just a gross mischaracterization of what defunding the police would look like and what a, you know, well, community policing alternative, if that's what you believe, or other non-militaristic alternatives. It's just a complete mischaracterization of all of that because he wants to stoke fear. He's not about having a reasonable discussion. It's about pushing an agenda and, you know, furthering white nationalist talking points. And, you know, like I said, stoking fear in the viewers. This, you know, this is not somebody who we should ever be giving a hand to or giving credit to because he dares to say that, like, bombing Iran is bad. You know, this is like so often people will run to his defense like, wow, Tucker's challenging the orthodoxy of the right. Well, no. Like, if you look at, like, one of the things that he really broke from the right on was escalating tensions with Iran. Mm-hmm. And it's not because he's anti-war. It's because, like I said earlier, he sees people there as, quote, his quote, semi-literate primitive monkeys. This is because he sees them as subhuman and not worthy of our time or effort.
Yes.
It's not about anti-interventionism. It's about he doesn't actually give a shit about people there and doesn't even want to bother with it. That's the root of his worldview. So to give him a hand is to applaud that type of sentiment. So I hate when people say, oh, we got to give credit to Tucker, because no, as someone who's watched his show endlessly to understand who he is and what he's pushing and document it, mm-hmm. not worthy of our time or applause or anything.
100%. Yeah. Yeah. And by the way, yeah, I'm glad that, you know, he occasionally cautions Trump against some of his absolute worst impulses, but he also supported the guy knowing how militaristic Donald Trump was. So maybe a little bit less
his son
than
was an,
a medal.
His son was an intern in the White House.
Yeah.
Like, and he parties with him at Mar-a-Lago. This isn't someone who is vehemently opposed to Trump. If you're partying with the president privately, you're not a bold, conscientious objector.
Yeah.
You're someone who's going to say enough on TV to get credit from both sides.
Yeah. Anyway, that's like a minute and a half of him. His shows over the past few weeks have, I mean, he's always been, I think, the worst on Fox News. Because Sean Hannity is so obviously comically biased. Tucker Carlson does a slightly better job of hiding it. And just disgusting recently. Multiple athletes have been coming out either in support or opposed to the protests that are going on, and that has left one big sports fanatic frustrated by the politicization of sports. Take a look at sports boy Ben Shapiro.
Now, Clay, it does make me wonder whether inevitably we're going to end up with basically two sports leagues, whether at some point people are just going to want a sports league that does not allow this sort of stuff to impede the play or get on the field. And people are just going to view that, because I got to say, like, I've been fairly tolerant of this stuff in terms of watching sports my entire life. There are only a couple of times where I've really turned off the TV. One was, you know, when it came to Sports Illustrated, I was a lifelong subscriber to Sports Illustrated. My parents gave it to me for my bar mitzvah. I had Sports Illustrated subscription for like another 10, 12 years. I used to keep the old issues in a box. I mean, that's how much I enjoyed it. And then when they decided, you know what, it's important for us to feature Caitlyn Jenner on the cover, when Bruce Jenner had not been an actual athlete for 3 decades. And all of a sudden I'm reading about transgenderism in Sports Illustrated. I was like, okay, I'm done. I can't do this anymore because this has nothing to do with sports. And I subscribe to a sports magazine. I'm not doing this anymore. And the other is during the Kaepernick protest, when it became incumbent on people to somehow approve of the hands up, don't shoot symbology that was being put out by particular players. I'm tempted to do the same with the NBA now that you have LeBron James, who was willing to basically virtue signal on behalf of the communist Chinese government, but rip Drew Brees. It's getting to the point where I don't want to watch sports. My place of comfort has been removed from me, and it may not be restored until there are actual sports leagues that remove politics from the sports.
There's obviously a lot of issues there. I'll give you first crack. What did you think about his defense of how the way sports used to be when there was no politics nearby it?
I don't know what era that was. I mean, maybe the 19th century, but, you know, through most of the 20th century, politics and sports have been deeply intertwined. We've had legendary moments at various Olympics through, you know, pushing back against Hitler and Jesse Owens, or the 1968 Olympics, where the sprinters, the United States Olympic team, held up their fists on the podium, mm-hmm. To various different types of protests in different sports leagues. Like, athletes have continually use their platforms to advocate for causes they believe in. We see even, you know, like maybe not as explicitly political, but activism and organizing and amplification of different cancer research efforts in the NFL. Like you have a captive audience. To not use it to further what you believe in would be amoral. So I think it's foolish and naive. It's just he's a whiny little baby is what it is. But even like on the local level, sports and politics is intertwined there because your tax money, and if you live in a city, is going to fund the arenas or the new stadiums and write-offs for these teams and these stadiums and the owners. So even at the local level, sports and politics are deeply intertwined because through levies and different sin taxes, you're paying for new arenas or you're giving them tax write-offs. So Even at the local level, it's still intertwined. But he's mad about the activism, and he's only mad about activism that goes against his worldview. And for someone who claims to be so open-minded and always willing to hear opposing viewpoints, like he's deeply upset and crying that people who have different outlooks than him have a platform and are using that to further their interests.
Yeah. Yeah, and I'm not surprised that he's taking time out to devote so much of his show to sports. He has multiple hours a day of programming that has to pretend that these horrific acts of police brutality aren't going on day by day. He has to, again, intellectual gladiator on the right needs to hide and pretend that he hasn't seen any of these videos and that the indefensible isn't being broadcast by people like you in the montages you've spread. Because, of course, he is morally and intellectually bankrupt. I love that in a time where protests are going on around the country about race-based discrimination and police brutality and systemic racism, his first solution is to go back to having separate sports leagues. I thought that was a nice little historical throwback there. I noticed that. I found it interesting that he said he had to stop watching sports on TV because of a magazine cover that he saw. And I think I'll just – the whole thing about him keeping a box full of Sports Illustrated, I'll just leave that.
I wonder which ones.
Fill in the blanks for yourself. Does he know that they have it on the internet? Anyway. And by the way, the fake, like, I just save me from the sports. Like, I can't take the politicization. I mean, LeBron James, he attacked Drew Brees. Wait, I mean, I don't like any commentary in sports. I wasn't saying that LeBron James is wrong, but Drew Brees was right. Although, of course, they are. The hypocrisy is 100% clear. It's just BS. As Jordan laid out, sports and politics have always been intertwined because sports is a part of American culture and society. Its athletes are some of the most high-profile, worshipped people in our society. They are going to occasionally comment on it, and they are not wrong to.
I mean, look at the NFL, though, and look at how the DOD has spent hundreds of thousands or millions of dollars for forced displays of patriotism at NFL games. The flyovers, the giant flag unfurlings, the salute to troops efforts, the troop returning home, you know, in between the first and second quarter, that kind of stuff, surprising their family. All these different displays of, like, American fascism and jingoism are, you know, being funded by your tax dollars, and they're forcibly interjecting these politics and that worldview into the NFL. Where's his complaints about that? No, it's a trans woman. It's LeBron James talking about China. It's Colin Kaepernick kneeling during this thing that the military paid for. It's not about just the existence of politics and sports. It's that people have a different opinion than him and he just can't handle it.
Yeah, and by the way, and it's also a demonstration of, I know he's supposed to be, he just sits and he just thinks about what's going on and he just understands things. He's shocked to find out that some people around the country aren't happy. And the only way he finds out about that is, it's in my sports now. Oh, is the trans community being you know, systematically persecuted across American history? He only finds out when it's on a magazine cover that he liked. This is what white privilege is. It's an ability to have your safe space be effectively the entirety of America. And all of the concerns that other people have, you don't even have to understand are going on. And that he doesn't like when that comfy little warm bubble he lived in occasionally was punctured by the harsh reality of truth, of what was actually going on. That's what he's whining about. This guy who has attacked safe spaces and snowflakes and made millions of dollars doing so just desperately wants his safe space back. and he's whining about magazine covers and someone kneeling on the sidelines of a sporting event. And pretending, by the way, I'll just say this, pretending to care about sports along the way. If I told you I don't like sports getting in my sports leagues, do I come off as a person who actually watches basketball week to week? Does that sound like the case? No. Okay, I've pretended to like sports. I know it when I see it. Anyway.
I mean, one final thing on the trans issue. So he's mad about Caitlyn Jenner being on the cover, which I don't really remember. I remember she had like a Vanity Fair or Vogue or something like that. I don't remember Sports Illustrated. Maybe she was. But to claim that that doesn't intersect with sports when the Daily Wire of probably any website, the Daily Wire and its pundits and commentators have obsessed over trans athletes in high school more than probably anybody else. For him to complain about that is just so deeply ironic and really shows how disingenuous this entire thing is.
100%. Yeah, and I get why he's mad, because after he saw that cover, the dude has not been able to see him, and I forget who the other guy, say Matthew, I forget. There's another
Matt
one of
Walsh.
The, no, yeah, it's Matt, and it's not, I'm the, oh, Michael Knowles. These
Michael Knowles, yeah.
People have not been able to stop thinking about the trans community for 5 consecutive seconds since it was first exposed to them, and it has just enraged them every day. Not enough, despite the fact that they're just overflowing with intellectual curiosity, not enough to actually speak to any of these people and try to understand what their lives are like and the struggles they face, but they sure do talk about the experience a lot.
Or just leave them alone.
That's what I would suggest. Don't talk at all, but my God.
Yeah.
Jesus. Multiple members of the Trump administration have spent the last day throwing Trump under the bus. First, here we have William Barr completely undercutting Trump's "I was just inspecting the bunker" argument.
Monday, we were reacting to 3 days of extremely violent demonstrations right across from the White House. A lot of injuries to police officers, arson. Things were so bad that the Secret Service recommended the president go down to the bunker. We can't have that in our country.
So, yeah, it's what we initially knew from the initial reporting, which turned out not to be fake news. They were spooked by the protests, which reporters on the ground say was incredibly peaceful. They took him down there. Okay, that's what we thought. He tried to lie and cover his tracks, but William Barr pulled that out from under him.
Yeah, it's, I mean, the I was just down there inspecting line is really funny. It's like, oh, are you crying? No, I just got some like dust in my eye. It's like one of those types of things that like a kid would do. So that the president is doing shows kind of like what a sensitive baby he is about this kind of stuff. So like that's really funny, and he's just like so deeply insecure. So, but then the overreaction then is, you know, going out and abusing protesters and tear gassing them and beating them back so he could have this like, and this is like, look, we laugh about everything on this kind of stuff, because if you don't laugh, you're just going to cry.
Uh-huh. But like, yes,
this was one of the most like blatant displays of fascist power.
Yes.
But that I can remember seeing. This was like so, so dangerous to think about. And he goes and he holds up the Bible, and his people within earshot are getting beat and tear gassed. It's so alarming. And this is the kind of stuff that we always recoil at when we see elsewhere, because it's a display of authoritarian control, and we need to go invade, and we need to bring democracy to those people. But it's happening here, and you've got people on Fox defending it and justifying it, and people on the right laughing about it. It's so alarming. But yeah, as no surprise that Barr undercut that entire claim, because yeah, I mean, that kind of makes sense. When you have that kind of unrest outside the White House, I would imagine that the same thing would happen if it was, you know, roles reversed and Obama was in the White House. I would imagine they would bring him down to the bunker just out of an abundance of caution.
Yeah.
But that he lied about it makes it very funny.
Exactly. It is just, if he had not cultivated this obviously false machismo, it would not be a running joke that he's actually a big wussy baby. But he made that a joke. In Barr's case, I like that Barr's throwing him under the bus. Specifically because I think Barr is an incredibly dangerous person who should not hold the position he holds. He should be thrown out of it immediately. That apparently is not going to happen. But if Trump ordered tanks to run over protesters, Barr would not stand in his way. He's an incredibly dangerous person. And so at this point, I'd just like to, if Trump is watching, hey, Trump, he called you a wuss. Fire him. You really need to fire him because he called you a wuss and he's making you look bad. But I say that because, of course, Barr is incredibly dangerous. And by the way, Barr claims that the tear gassing of the incredibly peaceful protest the day of the church trip was his idea. I don't know how that could be the case. It seems ridiculous. But if it was, then he is full lockstep with Trump, fascist all the way. We also have McEnany. So she was asked a question about... She was asked a question about Mitt Romney, marching with the BLM protesters, and this was her witty little comeback.
Kelly, does he agree in general the way that Mitt Romney stated over the weekend he does with the core message of Black Lives Matter?
Yeah, Mitt Romney can say three words outside on Pennsylvania Avenue, but I would note this, that President Trump won 8% of the Black vote.
Okay.
Burned. Burned. 8%? Can that even be charted? 8%.
That's almost 10%.
That is, I mean, I guess it's not technically a cell phone, although she's, involved in the campaign. If I was Trump, I would be furious about that because he likes to pretend that MAGA loves black people, which is an implicit statement that it does not involve them, but also that black Americans love him. I mean, that is just an amazing admission of how little appeal the GOP has for non-white, non-straight, generally non-male voters.
Yeah. I really don't know what to say to that. She's terrible at her job, we're seeing. Like, I mean, already this is just like way more gaffes and slips of the tongue than Spicer, I think, had collectively. Mm-hmm. She's not doing well. She's flailing. She's also put in this position in a really difficult time. She got a ton of things to justify suddenly.
That's true.
So, I mean, overall, really bad job, but this is hilarious that was her defense. So, I mean...
I had wondered when she got in, I forget exactly. So she had her initial thing where she like told the whole press corps, I will never lie to you. And that seemed really weird and buffoonish. I forget. There was something she said. It was like, it was something about she was supposed to deny that Trump had done something. And she said, well, Trump says he said he didn't. And she sort of smiled. And I said at that time, this is like day one or day two, she can't do this because you have to be able to, like Sarah Huckabee Sanders, just have the dead inside stare of nothing matters, truth is irrelevant, I'll say whatever I'm told to say. But she's like a pundit, like she smiles and she realizes how ridiculous what she's saying is. So I predict that she won't last that long. I don't know if maybe you disagree.
I think it'll come to a really embarrassing moment that blows back onto Trump, or she can't defend him, or, some type of like, situation. I don't know what you would call it, scandal or whatever, where he's embarrassed because of something she did. That'll be the final straw. But as long as she's going out there and defending him and just kind of tiptoes along that line, as much as we criticize her, it probably wouldn't matter. But if there's like some sort of thing where it blows back on him, he'll can her.
Yeah.
Because it's just about protecting him and his ego.
We'll see. I mean, if he wants them to do well, but not so well that they become the story, because then he gets jealous. But he definitely does not want them to embarrass him. And that sort of line, maybe you get one free. But if she keeps throwing off lines that make him look bad, if you think about him for even a second, it's not that he'll get it necessarily, or that he'll even think that his fans will get it. But if the media starts talking about how ridiculous it is, if she's generating conversations on TV, which he's perpetually watching, I think that could really hurt her in this particular career. Polls have not been going great for Trump recently, and perhaps as a result of that, his campaign has some new ad spending planned. They've been doing this for a bit, actually. Over the past month, the Trump campaign has spent slightly more than $400,000 on cable news ads in the Washington, D.C. area, buying time largely on Fox News, but with some smaller buys on CNN and MSNBC as well, which strikes a lot of people as odd. That you're running these ads in a place where you don't have voters, and some of it you can't even have voters, and you're running them on Fox News, where universally the people are going to support you anyway. It seems weird. Now, the campaign says that the ad buys were an attempt to reinvigorate and reassure the president's supporters in the nation's capital, which is blatantly false, but two knowledgeable sources, one a Trump campaign advisor, I love that his campaign advisors are leaking. And the other, an individual close to the president, said the D.C. area ads have another purpose, to put the president himself at ease. That as he's grown more and more distraught over his odds of re-election, they want to reassure him that they're fighting hard. Not by talking with him, but by running ads so that he'll see them. Because he's always watching TV, so he'll come across them. And he's been seeing ads from the Lincoln Group and things like that, and just getting so mad that they're spending hundreds of thousands of dollars to run ads for the candidate himself. I've literally never heard of this happening before.
It's hard to fathom just how like much of a baby he is. Like the just everything that we've talked about, like with the reaction to protesters and the story around him inspecting the bunker so that they resorted to a fascist, like aggressive display of power. And to now this, like, oh, his ego's hurt. He sees other commercials on TV. Now he wants his own commercials. I mean, this guy is like, I know like resistance libs like really delve into this, but like he is like he behaves like a child. He's just temperamental. He's reactionary. He's got a super fragile ego. And this is the consequence of him being surrounded by yes men and yes women his entire career. He's surrounded himself from people who will just agree with him and kind of affirm him with every decision. And this is the consequence. This is how it manifests. A president who just needs to see his own commercials on TV because he's sad.
Yeah.
You know, like, what a world.
Exactly. I guess they're going to raise so much money that I suppose they can afford to waste a few million dollars to keep him, you know, placated with Fox News ads and things like that. It is interesting, though, that for all that I hear about the fact that the right's best at memeing, you always hear like Benny Johnson and stuff say that like, hey, we got the memes. None of their ads have taken off. I mean, sure, Trump will retweet some like his face plastered on like Swamp Thing or something, and that owns us. I never get that, but in terms of the actual ads, like those Lincoln Group ads and Move On's ads and others have been so devastating to him over the past few months, with Biden being a candidate who's had so many flubs and weird misstatements and all of that, they don't seem to either have the will or the ability to put together something to counter on the substance the ads that are hitting him.
Yeah, I mean, they've tried before. They tried to hit him during the primary on like Biden not remembering things and stuff like that, but none of it really seemed to stick or get the traction that others we've seen on the left have. So you got to question like what their operation looks like and how efficient it is. You know, I think for a lot of people it's just kind of like a huge payday and they're just cashing in and assume that being an incumbent will help him get across the finish line. Yeah. But yeah, nothing really innovative or, you know, or exciting on the right that I'm seeing from the Trump campaign.
You know, in terms of cashing in, I'm glad that you pointed that out, because the thing is, he's temperamental. He turns on people if he thinks that they're failing him or they're not loyal. I mean, we saw he was like briefly apparently attacking Pascal because his polls were bad, as if Pascal could do anything about that. So if you're making ads for him, and you have a choice between making effective ads and running them in swing states, or making ads specifically designed to make him happy and running them in places he'll see them, I mean, are you really going to run the more effective ads somewhere else if that leads to you getting fired because he's angry randomly? No, you'll probably do what's necessary to keep your job. And that is no way to run a campaign. It's by no means a death knell for him. He could still do very well. He's still going to raise a ton of money. But you can't have your campaign running with the sole purpose of trying to make you feel good about things. It needs to be effective. And he is undercutting that, apparently. Every day we draw closer to New York's primary, and we are trying to profile as many candidates on the docket as possible. Joining us once again, candidate in New York's 13th District, James Felton Keith. Welcome back to the show.
Thanks for having me.
Very glad to have you on. I think it's been a few months since we last spoke, and you know, especially since the presidential primary has at least for right now basically wrapped up. There's a lot of renewed interest in congressional and Senate races, and so I'm assuming there's probably a lot of people that are watching this who might not have been around to see your last interview on the show. So if you'd like to introduce yourself to the audience, tell us a little bit about what led to this run. I'd love that.
Sure. So Hello to everybody. My name is James and Felton and Keith. Most people here in Harlem or uptown Manhattan call me JFK for short. Mm-hmm. You can call me James. I'm running for U.S. Congress in New York's 13th District. The name of my platform is We Owe Us. It's a platform of what we like to call radical inclusion or radical inclusionism. It is rooted in universal health care for all, a universal basic income, a universal series of education subsidies and infrastructure investments like the Green New Deal and criminal justice reform, just to name our sort of top five. Mm-hmm. But yeah, we're having fun so far. Now that the economy is starting to open back up and we're starting to get back outside,
yeah,
we're getting back to meeting people in the community. So
yeah,
that's been a big shift.
Yeah, I definitely want to talk to you about the actual mechanics of campaigning with the way things are. But first, on the platform, I mean, many of the issues that you just talked about, we have been rocked by emergency level, you know, crises. And so I'm wondering, if, like, the pandemic, the newfound national focus on reforming the police, have these provided, I have to assume they've provided opportunities for you to contrast yourself with the current incumbent.
Sure. I mean, even like this picture behind me was, you know, this is 1,000 people that we had in the streets in Harlem, and we walked everyone to the Upper East Side, which for the non-New Yorkers is a very affluent, you know, white part of Manhattan, just to show who we were, the people that we were, as we marched through these streets. And to our surprise, so many of them poured out from their homes into the streets. I think the main thing that the COVID-19 pandemic coupled with the police violence that we've seen is done is it is number one, showed our interconnected humanity and how we only get to thrive socially or economically based on the bumping up against each other that would normally go on. Mm-hmm. But also sort of shined a really interesting light on the very real injustices that have always existed since this country has started. So to my surprise, even, it's been a real boost to the campaign and to the conversation about the issues, the conversation that people usually claim that they are exhausted from having. I think there's a renewed energy in America right now where we realize these are the conversations that we have to consistently have. Exactly. So that's been an opportunity, but it's been unfortunate how we got there for sure.
Yeah. And also, I mean, so you're marching with 1,000 people, you know, these are people who are having to balance keeping themselves and others safe responsibly and being, just from the photo, you can see they're being far more responsible than some of the scenes we've seen playing out. There's footage from Vegas we were just talking about yesterday. With wanting to push for their rights, exercise their constitutional rights, while being pitched by national media as wild, lawless bandits, effectively, or operatives of Antifa or something like that. I can only assume that must be quite frustrating.
I actually had a close friend of mine who I used to work with in insurance call me and ask about the Antifa thing. He's a well-meaning, good guy, white guy from New Jersey, close friend again. And I had explained to them that, number one, that's not a thing. But with regards to the contrast of regular cities versus Las Vegas, I think is also exposing this very interesting paradox of freedom in America and what that means and for who gets it. There is this jockeying that we have here that's really not allowed in other places like, you know, China, et cetera. And I think, you know, we should be available to have the conversation, the very messy, dirty conversation about who gets to protest for their rights and how. Mm-hmm. You know, it was 85 degrees when we were marching last Thursday, and I wanted to take my mask off. And there were times that I had it off. But yeah, a lot of the people in the picture, they have their masks on. But, you know, the interesting thing about this time, again, is that we have to have the messy conversation about how we exist as humans that I feel like we've been avoiding for this whole century. Mm-hmm. I think the 21st century and the post-dot-com era has been a lot about trying to mechanically automate our way out of the messy conversations that we have to have about how we coexist in the melting pot that is America. And we don't get to hide from it anymore. I think that's a good thing.
So in terms of your ability as a candidate to have these conversations with the people that you aim to represent, I know some of the candidates we were talking to a month or especially 2 months ago, they couldn't have any contact out there. And especially for insurgent primary races, you know, grassroots races, they are campaigns that take place out there on the streets, knocking on doors and all of that. Now, things have obviously opened up a little bit, so tell me a little bit about the evolution of your campaign as we've gotten into the home stretch.
Well, you know, you're right. I got really sick at the beginning of March. I'm a bit embarrassed about this. I had a rally at a Democratic club that endorsed me here in Central Harlem on the 9th. And we were making jokes about Corona. I was like, you know, if Corona's coming, it's getting me and everybody else. And we were all laughing about it. And by the 11th, I was down. I was at home. Wow. And so I really just started coming out about 2 weeks ago. I lost about people in my building. Yeah, my mother's just getting out of the hospital. She's on oxygen. So we've been really rocked by the virus in general. And New York is a really interesting beast compared to, I would say, if I was running in a place where folks lived in single family homes, it would be different because you could at least walk up on the door and give them a flyer. Mm-hmm. Here, you can't get in the building. You can't get past the door person, number one, to slide a flyer under someone's door.
Yeah.
Mailings don't work enough. People like physical contact. And so that sort of shut down. The mechanics of a get off the vote spin in a place like New York is really about buying campaign staffers who live building by building. Mm. And we haven't been able to do that. We have gotten some growth on social media. I think the onslaught of absentee ballots has allowed people to get an opportunity to look at their ballot and then look at who's on the ballot and research everyone. But it should be said that that's a minority of the vote. That's a very privileged person is going to get an absentee ballot application, file for it, get the ballot back, research folks, and move forward. So we are hopeful that we made a big dent pre-February and that our district is divided. I would say, aside from the regular insurgent candidate conversation, it should be noted that our incumbent won here with, you know, an extra 1,000 or so votes. Mm. And the Harlem community really felt like they didn't have a candidate that represented them. And so we were running on that side of the coin to be here. And so it is a bit of a head-on race. I'd be lying to you if I said I wasn't worried. And that, you know, the coronavirus has radically transformed or changed how we politic in the area. But it has also changed the voter behavior of what we would call our triple prime voters. And we know that they're spending a lot more time doing a lot more research. Mm-hmm. So we're trying to be available online than we normally would be and explaining not only what my platform is, but also the contrast between myself and the incumbent. These last 3 months have been tough. As you know, you usually win or lose an election between March and May. For anyone out there who doesn't know that, that's really go time. Everything you do before that is sort of pre-game time, but you win or lose a race between March and May. And we weren't able to campaign between March and May. So.
Okay. Well, I mean, and you sort of hinted at this, it's also possible that, look, primary elections, Congress usually are low turnout affairs. I would guess, though, that politics is more at the forefront of people's minds than it has been for a very long time. And so it's possible that there might be more involvement, and that could radically change the outcome of some of these races.
We've played with a few different models. I mean, I'm an engineer, I'm a numbers guy, and we've been looking at the potential for turnout in certain areas. Yeah, certainly. I think that, the voter behavior has changed. And now politics is more of a consumer sport, for lack of better phrases, per Trump, how the radical things that he's doing, and the Democratic primary. And the fact that the presidential primary was moved to our primary on June 23rd is, you know, I think an interesting change. We actually thought we were benefiting earlier because the Democratic presidential primary was in April, mm-hmm. and we had time to watch sort of the exit polls from that come into June. And so I think, but arguments can always be made. You know, we're politicians, so everyone can make an argument either way that it's better because it's June.
Yeah.
But I'll say from a mechanical and planning standpoint, we're in uncharted waters. We're in uncharted waters. And at the end of the day, the main fight is around, at least for us, you know, justice and equity and inclusion. And so the fact that I feel like, you know, our platform and our principles are well known, not only here in the area, but are starting to trickle out around the country. And so that's been more than an opportunity. You know, we've been talking to people in Milwaukee and Cleveland and Detroit and Dade County and Miami and you name it about where we think the world is going in this decade. And that's really the work. Aside from winning, we want to win, but you know.
Yeah, exactly. And the primary is on the 23rd?
Yes, on the 23rd of June. A lot of people are already voting. People keep texting me and Instagramming me their ballots. So we'll see what the actual vote turnout looks like. I'll say this. I'm joining a broader national campaign to implement safe, sanitary, in-person voting. And I think this is a bigger deal than my race or any other race. And that if we cannot turn out Black people in urban areas, at least the 10 largest cities, to vote in November, we're looking at a very serious problem. Mm-hmm. And the early numbers that we're seeing come out of Maryland, I was looking at a race down there against Denny Hoya, I think the third district of Ohio, that Columbus area, and looking at my friend Morgan Harper. When we look at the turnout from those places via the absentee ballots, it's not what we would have hoped for.
Yeah.
And there's a lot of research coming out of the Brennan Center at NYU and folks at MIT and the CDC that absentee ballots don't change much in general. So I think the new conversation is, how do we invest in safe, sanitary, in-person voting? And how do we ensure that there is a normalized turnout in places like Detroit and Philly and Dade County and ATL and STL and Phoenix, Arizona, and you name it. If we can't do that, shout out to Charlotte, all those places. If we can't do that, we're in a different kind of trouble. A very different.
I agree. Very, very important work, obviously. And thank you for focusing on that. James Felton Keith, best of luck. Just a couple last weeks.
Thank you.
Appreciate you taking time out for us. I know you must be busy.
Good to see you again. Yeah.
Thank you. Thanks for listening to the full episode of The Damage Report. Support our work, listen ad-free, access members-only bonus content, and more by subscribing to Apple Podcasts at apple.co/TYT. I'm your host, John Adirola. I'll see you soon.